ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 12th of January. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. We begin with Victoria's bushfire emergency. Two emergency warnings remain in place for major fires not yet under control in the state's far northeast and southwest. Yesterday, the disaster took a deadly turn, with a person's body discovered near a vehicle in a central part of the state. The fires have burned through more than 390,000 hectares of land, destroying at least 300 structures and a significant amount of agricultural land. Dean Narrow Moore from the Bureau of Meteorology gave an update on the forecast a short time ago.
A couple of cooler and lighter wind days. That's today and tomorrow. So pretty fresh this morning as you're feeling it out there now. And that's going to see a sunny day, but lighter winds is the main story. Could see directions from, you know, southerlies and then easterlies, but it's all light. And that's the important note.
Those easing conditions surely welcome news for communities across the state. Already, a $19.5 million joint federal and state government support package has been made available to those affected. Some of the biggest losses so far have been in Harcourt, south of Bendigo, where at least 47 homes and three businesses have been destroyed. Our reporter, Oliver Gordon, was one of the first to enter the town.
I've just arrived here on the outskirts of Harcourt, and the CFA has given us an escort into some of the damaged properties, and I can describe what I can see in front of me: a burnt out car, a burnt out shed, a burnt out greenhouse type structure, but then most devastatingly, a house that has been almost completely leveled. I can see twisted corrugated iron that has collapsed onto broken brickwork. And really, this is still a live situation. We can see smoke still billowing out from some corners of this house, and the scrubland and bush around it completely blackened. Quite a devastating scene here.
You can see the flames up above the trees, and I thought I was going to lose my place for sure. It's very upsetting, I tell you. And I'm the lucky one.
Harcourt resident Noel Brown was in Harcourt when the fires came through.
It's terrifying. I live at the bottom of the hill there. I was very lucky. You know, you've got two firefighters, Ray and Tyrone Rice, that have spent their lives saving other homes. They've lost their house. I was extremely lucky. You just don't realise how bad it is until you're in the middle of it.
I can see just across the road just severe damage to the factory there, the railway, and I've seen a number of houses that have been lost. How does it feel? What emotions does it bring up?
It's just devastating to see. I can't believe how bad it is. The fire must have been a terrible heat for it to take the whole lot out. It was only about 28 years ago that the factory over here got burnt down too, and to see it happen again, it's just dreadful for the area.
We've moved closer to the centre of town now in Harcourt, and we can see just how indiscriminate this bushfire has been. To my right, the footy oval. It's almost completely unscathed. The grass is still green, and the cricket pitch in the middle of the oval is completely untouched. You could play a game of cricket on it tomorrow. I walk across the road, just 6 or 7 metres, and I can see a house that has been reduced to nothing but its chimney. It appears the fire has come through and the road has acted as a block between the cricket pitch and this home here.
Yeah, it's certainly come through here at some significant speed.
CFA Deputy Group Officer Nick Needham helped fight the fires.
Well, it travelled through this town under an intense wind condition coming from the northwest. Obviously, on Friday, catastrophic fire danger in this region. As we know, and as the Chief Fire Officer said, fires that start on those days are uncontrollable. And fire crews have done an amazing job through this area to save what properties they have.
And you can see it's almost random what houses have been taken and which have been spared.
I think that tells us how erratic the fire's behaviour was actually acting on the day. As you said, it was very random. You look on one side of the road, house untouched, the other side, you know, complete devastation. It just speaks to the erratic nature of these fires, particularly on those catastrophic fire danger days.
Authorities have told the ABC they're hopeful residents will be able to return to Harcourt to survey the damage in the coming days.
Oliver Gordon reporting from Harcourt in central Victoria. Demonstrators in Iran are defying a brutal government crackdown and further threatening the hardline Islamic regime's grip on power. The country is being cut off from the outside world, with a communications blackout reaching a fourth day. One US-based organization says almost 500 protesters have been killed and more than 10,000 detained. Here's Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran.
In Iran's second largest city, Mashhad, fires burn in the streets. It's a similar scene in towns and cities across the country, although it's happening in an almost total information vacuum, with the internet and phones blocked as authorities try to suppress the uprising.
Whenever they shut down internet, it's because they want to use their, as much as possible, their violence and their method of controlling people using violence.
Arina Moradi is a member of the Hungal Human Rights Organization, one of the groups which is trying to verify reports of dead, injured and detained Iranians. So far, it's been able to identify 60 people who've been killed, among them women and children.
We have received at least three videos, and two of them we verified that it is in Kahrizek morgue and warehouse, where dozens of bodies seems to be piled in the hallways.
The deadly force is being described by Iranian authorities as a firm, fast and sharp response to rioting. The country's president, Masoud Pezeshkian, with a message to the public on Iranian state TV.
Families, I ask you, do not allow your young children to join rioters and terrorists who behead people and kill others.
He's blaming others for twisting concerns about a broken economy into broader anti-government demonstrations, claiming enemies of Iran were encouraging acts of sabotage by protesters.
The United States and Israel are sitting there giving instructions to these people, telling them, go ahead, we are backing you.
In Iran's parliament, politicians chanted death to the USA. President Donald Trump's threats to strike Iran if protesters are attacked by Iranian forces reverberated around the world. The parliament speaker, Mohammed Bocher Holibov, issuing a threat of his own.
So that you are not miscalculating, know that in case of an attack on Iran, the occupied lands as well as US military bases in the region will be our legitimate targets.
His comment there on occupied land is a reference to Israel, the United States' key ally in the region. It was just 6 months ago that Israel and the US launched strikes on Iran's nuclear program and military assets, and the Israeli military has held briefings over the weekend about the current potential threat.
Israel is closely following what is happening in Iran.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country and the world is in awe of the Iranian protesters' heroism.
Israel supports their struggle for freedom and strongly condemns the mass massacres of innocent civilians.
Exactly how the US president will choose to act remains unclear, with the Wall Street Journal reporting he'll meet with senior officials on Tuesday to discuss it, considering everything from missile strikes to cyber attacks.
The Iranian regime right now is on high alert. They suspect that something might happen.
Danny Citrinovich is a former senior Israeli Defense Intelligence Commander and is now a senior fellow at the country's Institute for National Security Studies.
Definitely miscalculation can happen, and it will be very hard to find some sort of a sweet spot that will enable Trump to say, I help the demonstrators without deteriorating into full-scale war.
One thing is certain, Iran's Islamic regime hasn't been tested in this way for a very long time. This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
And for more on this story, the ABC's America's editor John Lyons joined me from Washington. Now, John, it's difficult to predict anything Donald Trump may or may not do, but how serious do these threats to attack Iran should it use lethal force against protesters appear?
Isabella, I think they are very serious threats. 6 months ago, President Trump warned Iran that if it didn't take serious negotiations in terms of its nuclear program, that the US would take action. It did. It bombed the Iranian facilities. He warned recently Venezuela in terms of US intervention if it didn't make certain concessions. Venezuela did not, and the US, of course, went in and captured the president. I think anybody who does does not take seriously President Trump's threats of military intervention at the moment. He's at the height of his powers, does so at their own peril.
But John, there are some inside the Trump administration warning against these kinds of strikes, saying it could have unintended effects like rallying the Iranian people to support the government or to further military retaliation.
Well, what we're seeing at the moment, Isabella, in terms of the Trump administration's foreign policy is very much a good cop, bad cop combination when it comes to the president and the secretary of state. The president is playing the tough guy, the bad guy, if you like. He's commander in chief. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, as the country's leading diplomat, is playing more of a moderating role. For example, on Greenland, Marco Rubio is saying military action should not be an option. It's about negotiation to get them to the table, whereas President Trump keeps raising military action. I think that there are some within the White House who worry that it will rally the Iranian people behind the regime, any external threat. When Iranians have had an external threat in the past, such as the Iran-Iraq war, they do tend to come together. So there is that dichotomy going on within the White House.
And John, you've actually been to Iran several times recently in 2024 for filming a Four Corners program. It's difficult to know what's going on exactly with that communications blackout. But what do you think might be happening on the ground right now?
Well, Isabella, Iran is the most brutal regime that I have ever seen. Up close, I have seen them take the full force of their security apparatus against their own people in the so-called Green Revolution. Anybody at the moment who goes onto the streets to join those protests does so at the risk that they will not survive. It is a brutal regime. These people are showing incredible courage by what they're doing, and I think the regime, its sort of default position is a brutal response. It has a very ruthless militia called the Basiji militia, who are civilian people who will be roaming those crowds. And the regime will not hesitate to kill as many people as it needs to survive from its point of view.
That's ABC's America's editor, John Lyons. It's a place where the community's most vulnerable come looking for justice, but it doesn't always feel safe. Domestic violence victim survivors at Catherine's Courthouse in the Northern Territory often find themselves face to face with their perpetrator. Lillian Rangia reports.
Catherine in the Northern Territory is a small town, and perhaps nowhere is that felt more than its tiny courthouse. It's a place where domestic violence victim survivors and accused perpetrators are funneled through the same entrance and security screening.
This Catherine Courthouse facility is not a safe and dignified environment for victim survivors of domestic violence.
Brianna Bell is from the Catherine Women's Information and Legal Service. She says in addition to the single entrance, there's no separate room where victims can wait for their case to be called, so they can be in the same space as their perpetrator for hours. There's also only one private meeting room, and it's often unavailable. So highly sensitive conversations with lawyers frequently take place outside where the whole town can see.
Which can be really, again, intimidating. It can feel really undignified. They can feel really worried about who's hearing these deeply personal stories. And it can really have an impact on their ability to open up and discuss things in the way they need to.
The Northern Territory has the highest rate of domestic and family violence in the country, and in a town of less than 10,000, it's estimated there will be nearly 600 domestic and personal violence applications lodged in the Catherine Court this financial year. Cindy Torrens is the CEO of the North Australian Aboriginal Family Legal Service. She says victim survivors' experience in the courts shouldn't depend on their postcode.
The Northern Territory's own domestic family sexual violence reduction strategy talks about the need for all Territorians to feel safe. And whether you're a court user in Catherine or a court user in Darwin, Aboriginal women or women in general, victim survivors are entitled to that sense of safety. And yeah, that's certainly something that the NT government can invest in quite readily with almost immediate impact.
Several years ago, architect Sue Dugdale's firm was commissioned by the NT government to design changes to the Katherine Local Court with victim survivors in mind. It comes after she redeveloped the Alice Springs Courthouse, adding many of the facilities being called for by advocates in Katherine. Her design is now before Cabinet.
We designed a second entry for vulnerable witnesses and a whole separate security location so they can come and go from the courtroom, and the only place they might see the accused is in the courtroom itself.
The NT government has earmarked $2.5 million on domestic and family violence support in the courts, but there's no mention of upgrades to infrastructure. Speaking last week, Northern Territory Attorney General Marie-Claire Boothby says infrastructure spending is not currently under review.
So our courts are very old, right across the territory. And of course, as a government, we look at infrastructure in all of those areas. And when the time is right that we can put forward something to have that reviewed and then of course funded, then we will do that.
Northern Territory Attorney General Marie-Claire Boothby ending that report by Lillian Rangier. Now, if you're a food lover, chances are you've heard of the Michelin Guide. You may have even dined at a Michelin-starred restaurant, but not here in Australia. Tanya Dendrinos reports on why Australia is yet to join the Michelin Guide.
Mise en place, it's the French phrase referring to culinary preparations, and it's in full swing at Sixpenny in the Sydney suburb of Stanmore. The head chef is Tony Skifaliti.
So over here, our chef Ronald is starting to caramelise all the beef trimmings, which you can sort of hear the sizzling in the background.
Sixpenny is one of the most celebrated restaurants in the country, but when it comes to the global culinary scene, there's a benchmark it can't yet seek to meet.
If you ask any chef or anyone that works in hospitality about the Michelin, I mean, I'm sure they could tell you about it and what it is.
The Michelin Guide dates back to 1900. Back then, it was a 400-page guidebook given to motorists free of charge. In the decades that followed, Michelin stars were introduced. One star denotes high-quality cooking and worth a stop. Two are for excellent cooking, suggested as being worth a detour, while a coveted three Michelin stars are awarded for exceptional cuisine worth a special journey. So, would it be beneficial for Australian restaurants?
There are sort of pros and cons to the argument. In my opinion, I feel like it would be nice to have it for a few reasons. And I guess one of those reasons would be that it would sort of put Australia on the world map.
Tony Skifaliti believes there'd be higher reinvestment into restaurants if Australia was part of the Michelin Guide, resulting in a better dining experience for customers and, importantly, help Australian businesses attract and retain talented chefs.
Chef shortage is a thing. You know, there are chefs out there, but trying to get the talent is the hard part. So, one, keeping Australian chefs here and also attracting other chefs from internationally to come over to Australia.
Tourism Australia says it was first approached to support Michelin as it explored launching the guide in Australia in 2016, with several discussions taking place since then. But the cost is prohibitive, sitting in the tens of millions of dollars, and state and territory tourism bodies would be required to pitch in alongside any investment from Tourism Australia. In a statement, a Tourism Australia spokesperson said, "We welcome any activity that shines a light on Australia's thriving food and drink scene and will consider opportunities where we can within our existing marketing priorities and budgets."
Michelin certainly has an international profile.
Richard Robinson is a professor of employment, work and studies at Northumbria University in the UK and was previously based at the University of Queensland. He's conducted research into food tourism.
It's even a thinner segment of the food tourist market who are primarily interested in just that fine dining or elite eating experience.
He describes this category as the passive food tourist.
They were the ones that were interested in sitting and dining, as opposed to a lot of other food tourist categories were much more active. They were interested in going to the farm and having the plate to paddock experience and learning about the provenance of food.
He says it's a relevant point to consider in the Michelin discussion and any future cost-benefit analysis. Michelin wouldn't be drawn on whether or not its discussions with representatives from Australia are ongoing, saying the Michelin Guide does not comment on potential expansion intentions until they are finalised and officially announced. Instead, it says its focus is on the upcoming launch of the Michelin Guide New Zealand in mid-2026, marking our first step into Oceania.
Tanya Dendrinos reporting, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.